This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this week's program, we feature a lecture given by University of Utah professor Annie Fukushima, who works in the Ethnic Studies Division in the School of Cultural and Social Transformation. Some of the areas of research that Fukushima focuses on is migration, human trafficking, violence, and sexual slavery. Her talk is largely based on the research compiled for her new book, Migrant Crossings: Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S., released last month. A quote for the book by Evelyn Nakano Glenn of the University of California, Berkeley, says Migrant Crossings brilliantly dissects our understanding of the plight of Latina and Asian women trafficked into informal economies of sex and service. Combining original analysis of court cases, news accounts, and police reports with the author's experience as a volunteer counselor, Fukushima reveals a legal system that requires a survivor's story to fit the model of perfect victimhood in order to cross into visibility and be deemed worthy of asylum. Fukushima's talk was recorded on November 6, 2018.
So just a little bit about me. I really value research and praxis. And so what that really means is the practice of theory. I do have a book that's forthcoming with Stanford University Press. I also have some scholarly articles that I'm happy to talk about. The poster, I think, also gives us an opportunity to talk about one of the articles I published on the cage, or the image of the cage. I also believe in praxis. So much of my work is about working in communities. I've done citywide assessments to also being an expert witness, which I'm happy to also talk about with folks if you're interested in these kind of other hats that I've worn in community. But for today, what I really want to talk about is witnessing. Witnessing is a central aspect to the work that I do. And so the question that really shaped my research is, who is seen as trafficked? How does a person cross into visibility? This is a central question that I'm asking in Migrant Crossings. And so to answer this question, I went into community, I did legal analysis, and also did ethnic studies methodology of a bricoleur, which we use the tools that are available to us, decolonial and transnational feminism. And much of my work is hemispheric, where I'm looking at Asia Pacific and its relationship to the Americas. For today, I'm going to focus on a particular chapter in which I discuss the Peruvian case. I'll be focusing more on a Latin American context. But I'm more than happy to talk about the other cases during the Q&A as well. So my work is about witnessing. And when I think about witnessing, I'm really interested in not just how we are spectators that are called to look at something, to long distance look at it and look at suffering from a distance, but I'm really interested in the actions that we're called to as witnesses. And that's what witnessing is. It's different than spectatorship because you're actually called to actions or inactions. And that's what witnessing looks like. But I wanted to unsettle witnessing because witnessing, oftentimes can also be problematic. And so a theory that I've been furthering is what I call an unsettled witnessing. And what this means is witnessing without being settled with what one is seeing, raising questions about normative aspects of events, paying attention to performances in institutions, and examining the politics of representation. And so for today, when I talk about the United States versus Dan case, I hope that we'll see together how I'm actually invoking an unsettled witnessing. And so in this particular one, again, I did some legal analysis. I looked at the socio-political process of labor and migration, and I looked at campaign materials as well and media discourse. So let's talk about United States versus Dan. United States versus Dan is a case that happened in 2010. Some of you might have heard about it. It was a case in which, in Walnut Creek, California, a domestic worker was trafficked into the home of her employer. Her employer, Dan, was known for being a property manager, for a retail management, and so really being seen as an upper-class Latina. She also herself, Dan, was from Peru, too. She was from Lima, seen as upper class, white, and she had brought into her home in 2007 this person that we will call Liliana. Liliana was brought into her home as a domestic worker, and the reason why she was recruited was because Dan needed help. She was going through a divorce. There are many changes in her life, and she needed support. to have that support in her home. And so when I was thinking about this case, there were some folks that I've been thinking with, scholars that I've been thinking with, Evelyn Nicano-Glenn, Perit Hondignu-Sotelo, Rosel Salazar-Perenas, Judith Rollins, and Mary Romero. These are folks that I really encourage us to engage with or encourage you to look into if you're interested in thinking more about domestic work. And in this particular case of domestic work, it was a servitude case. And servitude can occur, especially in involuntary servitude in the U.S., with babysitters, nannies, caregivers, domestic workers who are also doing these roles, but also maybe cleaning and other services around the house. So in this particular case, there were multiple witnesses. The witnesses in the court records end with one of the quotes where she says, "The organization Sage helped me with the basic things, morally, doctor, food, clothes, because that was the most important thing right then." And so in this moment, Liliana invokes how she was being witnessed by social services. She was a self-witness, but she was also witnessed by the community. And in her particular case, what led to her leaving her employer was that she had actually solicited the help of a gardener, of school teachers, and so eight of them together had actually organized this sort of rescue to get her out of her exploitive conditions. And so there were many witnesses, people in the community. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these examples. There's also the witness, which will be the reader of the book, but also you in this audience where you're witnessing this case. And then there's myself, who also participates in a witnessing. And so I want to make sure that as we think about the multiple witnesses, how we continue to trouble what we are seeing happening. There was a transnational perspective in this case. In this particular case, Dan had recruited Liliana from Peru. And so they actually knew each other in Peru. So Liliana had worked in Lima, but she actually was originally from Cusco. She went to Lima to actually start participating in the tourist industry. She was also doing domestic work for Dan's family in Peru. Race mattered in this particular case. You have an indigenous person, Liliana, who was working for an upper class considered white Peruvian. But the reason why she came, which is oftentimes part of the pull factors of migration, is she wanted to learn English, she wanted to learn how to drive, and she wanted pay. And not just to, these are important skills for what she believed eventually she would return to Lima, Peru, and she'd have skills where she'd actually be able to work in the tourist industry and be able to work in multiple languages. In this particular case, there was a story of her being considered the anti-frog. And so here, the prosecution that had taken up the case when they had found her being trafficked, they actually, at first, the prosecutor couldn't see her as trafficking. He couldn't see her as anybody except a domestic worker that looked like a typical story of a migrant who'd come to the United States. And so it took him a while to grapple with this case. It took him actually a long time to actually see somebody who had survived victimization. But one image that he was told, he invoked to describe how he was able to eventually see Liliana as a trafficked person. And so here is a quote from the defense. The defense actually didn't see her as trafficked, right? They see her as ultimately they came to live together, to work together, and even play together as a family. Not as a master and servant, not as a dominator and slave, but as almost sisters. One did betray the other. But as you listen to the evidence in this case, what you're going to discover, it was the nanny with the ulterior motives that betrayed Dan, not the other way around. So the defense was setting up a familiar story that we oftentimes hear in immigration. Here we have a story on the defense side trying to set it up as a story of somebody taking advantage of the immigration system. But the prosecution wanted to portray a different story, and that was a story of a fraud. And Andrew Wong, who was a prosecuting attorney on the case, had said, had described her as a frog. And many of you actually might be familiar with how to cook a frog story. Are folks familiar with that? How do you cook a frog, right? Just in case if you're not familiar with it, the story or the question goes is, how do you cook a frog? Well, if you put a frog in a hot pot, it'll jump right out. And so the lesson is that you put the frog in a cool pot and you slowly raise the temperature until the frog is cooked. And that was the image that he used to describe Liliana as a frog, a person who was slowly being cooked to the point that she eventually could no longer take it, right? But I call her the anti-frog because eventually, actually, Liliana left the pot and she didn't stay in there and stew until she was dead. But one of the things that came up, and so as I said earlier, the prosecution actually did not see this originally as a trafficking case. It actually took Liliana crying for them to see any kind of human experiencing abuse. And so tears were actually really central in her story. And so I'll give you an example of the moment or the breaking moment. So Liliana describes to the attorney, so throughout the interviews that she had with him, she never cried. And we can talk a lot about how in trauma, we all survive trauma differently. It looks different on our bodies. Some people may even smile through traumatic events or laugh. And in her case, she never cried until this one moment. And it was a moment in which her employer had told her for 2 years, you're not allowed to communicate with anyone outside of my house. So Liliana would walk the children to school every day, and she was told, you're not allowed to communicate with anyone. She eventually, she only had a radio. And so there was a radio that she would listen to the Spanish news and just get her Spanish information. And so that was the only thing that felt made her feel connected to an outside world. And it was in an altercation between Liliana and her trafficker where the trafficker took Dan took the radio and smashed it, that Liliana began to cry when she was telling the story to the prosecutor. This is the only moment in which she cried. And it was in this moment of tears that he actually could see somebody who'd been victimized. Before that, he could not see a story of victimization. It took her crying for him to see a legible survivor of 2 years of being somebody who for 2 years was not paid, for 2 years her food was portioned, where she was slowly starved, where her trafficker would literally weigh food, and in order to survive, Liliana would, when she would walk the children to school, she would pick fruits from a tree to survive. And so she found ways to enact her agency, but in order for the attorney to see a migrant who'd experienced a crime, it took her crying for him to see any kind of legibility of surviving. And this is something that I've been thinking a lot about, is victimhood and criminality. How in our current discourse, and this is what the book really grapples with and troubles, is that migrants are often bound to being seen as victims or criminals. And in this particular case, there was a lot hanging on it for her to be seen as a victim. And it took tears. Translation also came up quite a bit in this particular case. One of the things that I learned at the end of the court, when it had closed, so Liliana ended up winning her case against her trafficker. And so in this particular case, there was translation throughout. And so here we have a moment that was where the translator would say, Your Honor, the interpreter needs to ask for repetition. Your Honor, can we slow down a bit? And he would say throughout the court transcriptions and throughout the court case, wait, wait. It was interesting to me to think about court performances and translation, because if you actually were to watch it, he was performing. So when her tone would raise and her pace would get excited, he would follow. And it became a performance in which the translator, it was more about the translator's performance, even though it was really supposed to be a story about Liliana. And so in this particular case, one of the things that I ask is, what does it mean to translate that which someone may or may not desire to forget, and memories that are haunted by hypermemory and forgetting? So throughout the court, there's an expectation of it going from front or from beginning to end. And when we interview survivors of trauma and violence, they actually don't remember things that way. It's disrupted, it's out of order. Things that might seem so important to them but is not even a part of the trafficking story, right? Come to the fore, a story of crossing borders, a story of about the radio. And so in the court, though, one is expected to perform this from beginning to end retelling. And Liliana took to the court in which she testified against her trafficker. And she was expected to tell a story that had that started at a beginning and then eventually had an end when she left. And memories don't always work that way. And so this testimony is constructed out of memories that are best fragmented, misremembered, and then constructed as linear. So this is a particular case that I really grapple with around victimhood and the perceptions of victimhood, as well as notions of legality and illegality. Liliana was actually seen as a perfect victim. This was a case that actually went through, and if you were to talk to Homeland Security, the FBI, as well as the prosecuting attorney who wasn't convinced initially, eventually they all agreed it was a perfect case because they could show force, they could show fraud, and they could show coercion. She was told lies about what she would enter into. She was threatened about immigration. And actually, this particular case was seen as one of the hallmark cases in California where we finally understood why coercion in our trafficking laws mattered. Because in this particular case, what her trafficker did was she would literally show her newspaper clippings of what this country does to migrants. She would show her newspaper clippings of how migrants are deported and tell her, see, you're safer here with me. And that was a way that she was coerced, right? Because then the fear was, what happens if I leave? What happens if I leave these conditions that are already horrible, where I'm not being fed, I'm not being paid, and I'm slowly dying, right? And so this was a hallmark particular case around that. And one thing I do want to read, though, is the closing in this chapter, because it's quite a complicated case about witnessing victimhood, but also notions of legality. In this particular case, she eventually became a legal migrant. She came here legally with a visa, but overstayed her visa. And actually, in much of the cases that I've worked on human trafficking, most migrants actually come in with legal documents. It's just they eventually overstay, and then they become undocumented. So there's a myth in, around human trafficking and migration as though it's a story of migrants who are taking advantage of our borders. Most of them do come in legally. And so in her particular case, she came in legally, and eventually, because of the fraud of her trafficker, she overstayed her visa. She was coerced, and there was one altercation of physical violence. But through it all, most of it was mostly psychological coercion. And so to close, I end with Dan, who never speaks. Therefore, the public only witnessed her silence and mediation through other actors. Dan is an immigrant, a Limeña Peruvian, a mother of three children, a divorcee, a former real estate agent, a Berkeley alumni, a now convicted felon who served time in jail. Dan's story always mediated through other actors, the U.S. attorneys, the public defense, and the witnesses that took the stand, such as Liliana, a Homeland Security agent, an interviewer for the U.S. Embassy, a senior security representative for American Airlines, officers of Walnut Police Department, a computer forensic agent, parents from the school her children attended, the head custodian at the school Dan's children attended, a gardener, the gardener's employer, a property manager for the apartment building, her children, Dan's ex-boyfriend, her brother, and her brother's girlfriend. The courts never hear Dan's narration of her own story. Even though witnesses describe moments of choice, even at the moment of arrest, prior to her arrest, Dan requested to be taken to the hospital to have a medical checkup. Although she was arrested, it was on her own terms, albeit limited. Similar to Liliana, Dan is always represented through other witnesses. But in contrast to Liliana, Dan never takes a stand. In a way, although problematic, how the media described Dan best illuminates how she is witnessed. Quote, on Monday, Dan saw KTVU's camera and covered her face with what appeared to be a ski mask and goggles as she took her children to school, end quote. A person attempting to live a life beyond the eye of the public, she was always in it and interpreted by it, covered yet on display. Through an unsettled witnessing of United States versus Dan, I'm left with a witnessing that is bound to possibility and irreconcilable tensions. As the Department of Justice has taken the center in the anti-trafficking movement with prosecuting human trafficking cases, United States versus Dan highlights that an anti-trafficking narrative is equated with a legal system, arresting traffickers. However, how this enabled rights for Liliana is unclear. By the time of her trial, she only made $1,100 a month and lived in a shelter in San Francisco. Although she owed money, it is not clear if Liliana will ever see restitution and civil claims ordered by the courts. Liliana conveyed during her testimonial that she wanted an American justice. Therefore, Dan's arrest and conviction may or may not have been justice for Liliana, but it is an American justice, leaving one to wonder what is a Peruvian justice, a woman of color justice, or even a decolonized justice. As anti-traffickers are called to witness Liliana and Dan, one is left with a contradiction surrounding how one witnesses a legal system and individual experiences are framed by U.S. perceptions of victims and criminals and colonial limitations. However, the possibility of what seems impossible, reconciliation with the limitations, and an imagining of witnessing beyond what is seen as an important decolonial maneuver for the global modern economic system, working for an unsettled witnessing within the confines of colonial systems must be imagined and enacted. This matters where human trafficking is being witnessed regularly through a range of contexts, the internet, in film, in news, in schools, even in conversations where stories are passed down from one witness to another, both locally and transnationally. And so for today, I just really wanted to share an excerpt of this chapter of a book about migrant crossings, where I talk about Asian and Latino migrants who are being witnessed as trafficked in the United States. And what does it mean to witness migrants who experience violence at the border and when they cross the border into the United States? And so I'd like to use this now, the rest of the time, to open it up for question and answer now. Thank you.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are re-airing a talk given by University of Utah professor Annie Fukushima on her newly released book, Migrant Crossings: Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S. In the next segment, Professor Fukushima takes questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Thank you, Dr. David Rowe.
Hi, Professor Fukushima. Thank you for your talk. I just had a quick question, a point of clarification, because you talked about how there was a moment in the case where there was a transition from a case about domestic servitude to human trafficking, mm-hmm. and that was predicated upon this sort of moment of pathos where Liliana had to weep to register to her lawyers that this is actually about human trafficking. But what Is it just about perception of based on pathos, or is there like a legal distinction between the two terms?
So there is definitely a legal distinction. So when we work in the legal system, we are using the legal definition of human trafficking. And I didn't define it because I wasn't sure if that would be of interest to folks, but it's actually human trafficking is a new definition. We didn't legally have the definition until 2000 under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And the Trafficking Victims Protection Act came into existence because there was a case of the Kosminski case in which farm workers who had disabilities were being trafficked, but they didn't use that term at the time. It was slave-like conditions, and they couldn't understand why they didn't leave. Why didn't they just leave these abusive conditions? And this was in the 1980s. And so then what ended up happening is years of advocacy and years of organizing in legislature led to the creation of a federal definition of human trafficking. And so when we use the federal definition of human trafficking, it's quite complex. If I were to tell you what it is, it is when a person is recruited, harbored, transported, solicited, the list, there's another one that I'm missing, for the purpose, through force, fraud, or coercion, for the purpose of their debt bondage, slavery, sex, or labor. And it's quite a long legal definition, but one of the three things that we oftentimes look for when we do work on human trafficking to see if it fits into what be legally understood as human trafficking is force, fraud, or coercion. And not all three things have to be happening. You just need one thing to be happening. But we have found that actually fraud is one that gets attached to force or coercion. There are actually very few cases where fraud alone is seen to move forward. And that's just a nice way to say somebody tells you lies. And so migrants might come to the United States believing that they are going to work as a domestic worker and be paid a substantial amount. But in the case of Liliana, the terms is not what she agreed to, which is no pay and eventually no food. And so that's how we oftentimes use the definitions. We use a legal definition. But for me, when I've been working years in community on human trafficking, there is a legal definition, and the legal definition might sound like a case that one is describing. And the curiosity becomes when the legal definition sounds like what you're seeing, but people make decisions to not actually see it as trafficking. And so instead it becomes a criminal case, or it becomes a case where a person is deported, or it becomes a case of something else. And we've seen this time and time again. And I can give you a number. For example, every year we have a cap of 5,000 visas that migrants that are trafficked can apply for. 5,000. We have never hit the cap ever in a year. It took us 10 years for us to even issue 5,000 visas. 10 years. So we can have 5,000 visas every year for migrants that are trafficked, but it has taken us 10 years to even reach 5,000. And that's because the standards are so high and the rejection rates are really high too. And so migrant crossings really became a question about how we witness some people coming into visibility as trafficking subjects and others as not. And so when I think of the attorney, it took that moment of crying that actually was a really important moment for Liliana, for him to see some kind of victimhood. Otherwise, she would have been seen as an undocumented migrant laboring here in the U.S. and whatever moral values that one attaches to that. Yeah. Thank you. Dr. Erin Beagley? Yeah.
Hi. Thanks. So I was wondering whether you could say more about the gendered aspect of this performance, because crying is something that's like very gender normative, right? Yeah. It's okay for women to do. And so it's the fact that you have to, and it's also like, it's almost like the expected mode of emotional, like whatever. So I don't know. And that seems a little bit problematic to me, right? That would be necessary. So I don't know. I wanted you to say something about that, but also maybe distinctive ways in which people who are non-gender normative or not women have been able to be recognized, or the difficulties in that.
So the performance of crying is definitely gendered. For sure. If you look at even campaign materials around trafficking, women and girls are oftentimes portrayed. And I think that when we even think about this notion of victimhood, it's definitely a gendered story in human trafficking. And so we know that men are trafficked. We know that the trans community is trafficked. We know that all ages have experienced trafficking. I've worked on cases of 54-year-old being trafficked, right? It's a whole range, right? But there is a narrative that that is being told around what a particular victim looks like. And Jureshi Srikanti, a legal scholar, actually talks about it as the ideal victim. So we have an ideal victim that exists and continues to persist both in the legal courts as well as in the media. And it continues to circulate in both contexts. And these sort of images of an ideal victim are powerful. Because if you don't look like an ideal victim, somebody who's crying, showing that trauma has happened to you in a way when not everyone cries, it can be problematic, right? Then that person might be relegated to deportable, criminal, illegal, right? And so it is definitely a gendered story. Even in this particular case, gender came in interesting ways. She had been recommended that she dress as poor as she could look, right? But what did she do? When she showed up to court, she wore this beautiful bright sweater, tight-fitting skirt with high heels, and her hair was up, and she was wearing beautiful makeup, and she walked into that courtroom and not looking like a person who was actually living in poverty by San Francisco standards, right? And she looked amazing. And we could discuss what did that mean to actually confront one's abuser and look amazing, right? After years of poverty and not being allowed to wear what you wanted to wear, that's also a common thing that happens to domestic workers and trafficking, that are trafficked, their employers will tell them what to wear. Right, and because of sexual images of a domestic worker or assumptions about her sexuality, in this particular case, her trafficker really wanted her to dress, for lack of a better word, ugly, right? And so there's definitely gender operating throughout the case, and I talk about it in the book chapter, where it's homosocial violence. So when we oftentimes think about violence, we think of men's violence against women. But what does it mean to take a story when it's a woman participating in heteropatriarchy herself, right? Women participating in that violence too. And that's what this case example highlights, is that women also participate in those systems of violence. It doesn't mean that it's not still operating because a woman enacts violence. But yeah, the tears, it was an interesting thing to think about it. And I've literally done interviews with migrants who've experienced violence and had them go across the experience or show and exhibit in their body different things, because trauma literally does affect us differently. Literally, a woman who had experienced a janitorial abuse, she was a janitor, and also sexual abuse, she literally smiled throughout her entire interview, right? And it seems odd, right? But that's how her body was responding to what she was telling. So who am I to judge, right? Who am I to judge how one survives violence? And that's why thinking about the ideal victim is important, and we have to complicate it, because there isn't an ideal victim. There is a victim that is created through the stories that we circulate, right? They're all complicated, but victimization does happen. Yeah. So we'll have the microphone come this way. And what's your name?
My name's Justin.
Hi.
So, I'd like to follow up on the, I don't remember that gentleman's name.
Dr. Rowe. Uh-huh.
So for the pathos part,
I'm sorry, your name is Jason?
Oh, Justin.
Justin, sorry.
Was
Justin.
The information, so did the tears come first and then the information, or was, because the information like being rationed food and limited freedom, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I think that would be independent of the tears. Mm. And then kind of to follow up on that, you know, the gardeners.
I'm not really sure what you mean by that. Can you clarify your question?
Yes, yes, yes. No, it'll have to, building on with that, with the gardeners and the other people who knew her personally, they could mm-hmm. see clearly traffic conditions. But as a, mm-hmm. just a general populist member, and I can't really see that often, mm-hmm. and to prevent false positives, you know, like, oh, I see you as perhaps a traffic victim. Mm. What type of resources would you point to help just a general populace to prevent false positives, that stereotyping, say like, oh, I just assume you're a traffic victim because you're looking poor, mm-hmm. you're female, and you're a minority, and then complicating this already complicated situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually is very interesting because, yes, you're right. Liliana labored for years, and there were people in the community that she was interacting with. She was told she was not allowed to talk to other people, but some of the school teachers did reach out to her and did try to connect with her, right? And then they slowly started to learn about her story of how she was not being fed and all these other things, other aspects of her story of not being paid. Eventually, they were able to organize to get her out of those conditions. But your question about whether or not we as a public should be seeing victims. And I think that's where I'm interested in us grappling with. Because then the question is it our responsibility to be citizen police? Right? Is that our responsibility? Or is it the logics in which it's like, what about just seeing her as a person? Right? And that was something that was interesting about how these school teachers would reach out to her because they were interested in who she was. And that's why it took time for them to develop that relationship. Some of the cases in which we've worked at similar other cases of domestic servitude that we've seen, and I say we, like people who work on these issues, is that what we know is that in cases of like domestic servitude, a person is more likely to run to somebody they know than somebody they don't know. And so there was a case in which this boy in Antioch of California was, it was considered a shackling case. So it looked more like the stereotype of what we would consider trafficking or imagine it as a stereotype. And he was literally shackled during the night. But during the day, he would do his domestic work and do his work, and he'd take out the trash. And every day when he'd take out the trash, there was a neighbor who would say hello to him every day. And when he was able to flee his conditions, the first person he ran to was the person who said hello to him every day. He didn't know if this person could do anything for him. He just knew this person as friendly. And so I think that one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is sort of these kind of connections that we can make with a person beyond seeing them as a victim or as a criminal. And so that's, I think I would want to trouble, is it our responsibility to look for victims, or is it our responsibility to make connections with a person that sees them outside of victim or criminal, right? I'm not the enforcement of laws, right? And so that's just a query that I hope that, you know, to engage with your question. And the first question about the order of things, in the interviews, they have particular sets of questions and models that we ask. Usually it starts with your story of immigration, then it moves into your labor conditions. And so all of the things that she has been experiencing, which included other kinds of exploitation, whether it was labor violations, were coming out in her story. So it was clear that she was somebody who was experiencing abuse, but it was clear that she did not cry until she talked about the radio. And part of it, we can talk about resiliency. Maybe she's the kind of person who doesn't like to cry. Right? I don't know, right? There's all kinds of things that one can think about when it comes to tears. But what is interesting about the witness, it was only in that moment that he recognized victimization was when she started crying. And that's what I'm interested in, is in that moment of recognition. Why did it take her crying for him to see her victimization when throughout her interview she was telling a story of abuse?
That's Professor Annie Fukushima from the School of Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today we are re-airing a talk given by University of Utah Professor Annie Fukushima on her new book, Migrant Crossings, Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S., released last month. In this final segment, Professor Fukushima takes more questions from the audience.
Hi, Quinn.
Hi, Dr. Fukushima. Can you talk a little bit about movements, whether it's with survivors of human trafficking, domestic violence, sexual assault, coming from like a trauma-informed, victim-centered model? And, you know, we like to label people as like illegal immigrants. We hear terms like migrants, but how would Liliana identify herself, and what identities do you gain when you come forward as a victim, and what's the exchange there? Because I feel like it's so easy to just classify someone as one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, people's identities are complex. And so in the case of Liliana, she saw herself as from Cusco, as indigenous, as speaking Quechua. She talked about her identity that way. She talked herself as somebody who worked really hard. And that's who Liliana was this person who actually worked really hard. She was willing to be paid minimum wage. So even after her exploitation, she continued to work in domestic work, not because that's what she envisioned herself doing as a career, but because of job discrimination. Those were the kinds of jobs that she could get, right? So she had a legal visa to work, and those were the only jobs that she would get. And so she would work as a domestic worker even after a life of abuse in domestic work, right? She continued to work in it. So there's been organizing with the National Domestic Worker Alliance to create more sort of these organizing amongst domestic workers, and actually Liliana got quite involved in that. She was organized with the Domestic Worker Alliance. And so herself, she became an advocate of justice, as well as an advocate for others, I would say. And so your first part of the question, though, can you repeat that?
So you talk about anti-trafficking being like a very heavily like prosecution-based industry right now, and wanting to move toward like a more victim-centered, trauma-informed model. So can you talk about like the importance of involving survivors or people who've actually experienced those instances?
So there has been a national network of survivors through the Freedom Network. And so they actually organize survivors who actually experience this to advise and provide consulting. That's been one way that survivors have been at the front and the center. So that would be one way, one model. This sort of trauma-informed, survivor-centered model is actually not new. If you look back to the 90s, anti-trafficking organizations have been actually centering the perspective of survivors. So there's multiple agencies that actually center that, whether they were SAGE. Standing Against Global Exploitation was an organization that was founded by survivors, for survivors. And so that was an organization that was supporting Liliana. And I think one of the things, Quinn, you're pointing out is, yes, we need to listen to survivors, right? And actually, when people experience victimization or any other kinds of violence, many of them don't identify as trafficked. We just did a study here in San Francisco, Quinn and myself. We just did a study here, and that was actually true here too. Most survivors of violence in Salt Lake City who have survived trafficking don't immediately identify that way. It's a complex definition, and actually if you look at the legal definition, most people don't even know that what they experienced might actually be trafficking, right? Because for them, it just might be how they labored and that they didn't get paid and they experience these things, but they seem so normal because we've normalized violence, right, in the U.S. And so that's to kind of get at the survivors. So Liliana might have a different identifications. She eventually did call herself a trafficking survivor because legally she was positioned that way, right? Legally she was situated that way, and so she did use that. But I've worked with migrants and U.S. citizens who actually still won't use that term to define their experience. And so when we talk about numbers, the numbers only show us what we can see, what we know. They don't show us all of the things that are unknown, right? And there are many survivors, and we see this even with sexual assault and domestic violence, who still don't even use these terms to define themselves, even though these are very common terms that have become visible, right, in the U.S. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, thank you. Loved your presentation. I am here. I think most people of us are because we want to do something to help out. So if you were to articulate your witnessing language into a specific call to action for us, how would you do that?
Great. So I think that one of the things when I think of human trafficking, thanks for your question, I think of human trafficking as complex. And so when I think about it as an issue about poverty, an issue about immigration and violence against immigrants, an issue about heteropatriarchy and gender-based violence, and the list goes on. I think people that are doing work to tackle those things are implicitly doing anti-trafficking work because you're tackling the issues that intersect with it. Even if you're doing housing rights, if you're doing environmental rights, these are all important strategies. And so my appeal wouldn't be to say, like, you all need to be anti-traffickers. only if it makes sense for your worldview and what you feel like you are compelled to do. And if that's something you're interested in, there is the Asian Association of Utah. They work with migrants here in Utah, in which they are the identified organization who receives federal funds to support survivors. And so they're one organization. They're part of the Utah Trafficking in Persons Task Force, which is more law enforcement organized, and so there's those folks as well. There's also the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, which is a hotline that you can call. So if you are familiar with, or if you want to, if you think you're seeing something and you don't know what to do, they're really good at letting you know what the resources might be for you. They're kind of a resource center. So the National Human Trafficking Resource Center with the Polaris Project. Polaris Project was founded in the early 2000s, interestingly enough, by undergraduates at Brown University. They were they had read a newspaper about survivors of human trafficking in massage parlors, and they wanted to do something about it. So with their wealth and their resources and their legal friends, they formed the Polaris Project. And so they themselves got activated, and they turned what started in a dormitory room into a national organization. And so I think that when it comes to addressing the violence in our communities, it's just a matter of will and a matter of energy, right? If you have the capacity, there are so many organizations doing this work. There's also Kids in Need of Defense working with young folks who have been experiencing our immigration systems. So if you're interested in working more in the legal route, there's organizations like that. And so I guess to answer your question, it's two ways. There are many organizations to be involved in if you're interested in that. But if you don't have the time, then it just becomes sharing the information that you learned. And I think that's an important aspect of educating on how we become critical witnesses to what's happening in our communities in a way that means that we aren't surveilling our neighbors, though, right? That we are critical, that we come to know this person, and we actually enact, what I've been thinking a lot about lately is a radical practice of friendship. What would that really look like, right? That kind of critical friendship with another human being, right? And that's actually really hard to do. Rescue and raids are one response, but they can be really traumatic for migrants who are actually experiencing a rescue or a raid because they don't know who you are. They don't know anything except if there's law enforcement with guns. It might make them actually feel more unsafe. And we've actually had survivors who were suicidal ideation after a law enforcement raid. And so there needs to be, I think, when I think of doing anti-violence work, a multiple response. It can't be singular. There's different things that need to be happening, like a rhizome where we're all rising up like ants coming up from multiple points. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I have a more of a sort of big picture contextual question. I did get a sense from your presentation that there's a lot of invisibility associated with trafficking and trafficking victims. Can you give us, as one way to make this more visible, a sense of sort of the global scale of trafficking, and then put the U.S. in that context? How common is this in today?
Yeah, you know, there is a website that you can go to. It's called the... where it's by Kevin Bells, and they actually have numbers where they calculate how many people are trafficked worldwide. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. I always am critical of numbers because I actually think that they just, it just depends on how you're collecting that information. And so they might use like labor laws, criminal court systems, as well as they might use environmental and all these other things to describe what they think is happening worldwide. But that's just based on what we think is happening. And the reality is, and this is like super cliche, but a lot of folks say this in the anti-trafficking movement, survivors don't raise their hands to be counted. Somebody has to witness them that way for them to be seen, whether it's a legal system, the immigration system, or social services, or law enforcement, and the list goes on. And so we actually don't know how many people are trafficked in the U.S. because the numbers that have been thrown out there have never really been very accurate. We just don't know. They used to throw out numbers like 14,000 to 17,500 people trafficked every year into the U.S., right? That was one thing that the U.S. Trafficking in Persons report used to produce every year. Now, if you look at their report, they don't even name the numbers, and they just talk about how many cases are being prosecuted and how many cases are actually where survivors are being Health and Human Services identified. But then it goes back to the picture of those are who we see. And so when I've done presentations like this on human trafficking, one of the things that we know, and this it has happened to me many times, where young folks and friends will say, you know, what you described sounds like something my parent went through, right? This is exactly sounds like something that they labored in, or an aunt or uncle or another friend or them themselves, right? And so the question isn't, should we immediately appeal to see them as trafficking, but if they do identify that way, then what are the resources available to them? And currently, when organizations do respond to human trafficking, every single need a person has, that's what they're responding to, and it's quite complex. Housing, to looking for work, legal needs, the list goes on. I guess to answer your question, the U.S. has a self-perception of itself, and you can see this in the U.S. Trafficking in Persons report, that we're doing a really good job, right? That American exceptionalism is actually not new, right? And Wendy Hesford talks about this in her work of that sort of U.S. exceptionalism, right? And so we have a notion of ourselves as doing things better. But the question then becomes, and advocates have been looking at the way that what we know is that when the border gets more tight, it means that if migrants have to cross it, they take more dangerous paths, right? Which makes them more vulnerable to other kinds of violence, whether it's trafficking or whether it's something else, right? I think that one of the things is that, so it's just hard to say in this particular moment. We don't have hard numbers, but what we do know is that it is happening here in the U.S., and that the invisibility is that we are more likely to run and respond to a child who's been abused and see that they are being victimized than to see an adult who's been experiencing it. So why can't we see the humanity in an adult who experiences abuse, right? And that's where the appealing to witnessing is important. It means that we have to actually enact a kind of way of seeing a person really differently. And that's not an easy practice. If you've been taught to see them as a threat, to see them as dangerous, then how do you undo a whole lifetime of seeing somebody as dangerous when they're a person? So sorry, I can't really, but in the scale of things, we think we're doing well. But then if you go and you work with organizations and community, they always complain about how they just don't have enough resources. They don't have enough resources to support community.
That's University of Utah professor Annie Fukushima speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about her new book, Migrant Crossings: Witnessing Human Trafficking in the U.S., released last month. If you'd like to hear Fukushima's full speech or listen to other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.